okay, can you guys believe that Seth left the video camera alone?
That's right.
So here we are, it's 2015, November 3rd, MVP Summit, and Seth Juarez walks away from the Channel 9 camera to get lunch. And so the F-Sharpers are commandeering a table, and we've kicked off the record button. And so yeah. We're just going to talk. So I'm Brian Hunter. And I just hit my mic, so I'm Brian Hunter. We don't have a sound guy back here to keep this all straight because we're all rogue. But and
I'm Matthias Brandewinder from San Francisco. You can guess that from the accent.
I'm Tomáš Petříček, living in Cambridge, originally from Czech Republic. Another F-sharp person who always runs in front of camera whenever he sees it.
I figure what we'll do is we'll just talk until Seth gets back, and then hopefully this will make it in the rotation where he doesn't actually notice it. It'll play at the end of some ASP.NET thing or something. So we were talking about maybe talking community, F-sharp in the community, polyglot. We're thinking maybe you're talking.
How about we just talk about what gets us excited with F-sharp?
Yeah, right on. Okay, yeah, what gets you excited, Matthias?
Maybe we'll start with Thomas.
Should I start? Well, I think in my case it's kind of interesting because I've been doing F-sharp for, it's scary, but I think 9 years now.
Wow, okay.
And so, the language itself still gets me excited occasionally, but the main reason why I'm still doing it is the community around it. Mm-hmm. And, there's a lot of really nice things happening in the open source world. What gets me excited is that there's still a lot of people doing really nice projects. Using F-sharp that either make my life more pleasant as a developer or just let me do a lot of new interesting things that I wouldn't even thought about doing before.
Yeah, and you were saying that there is also a habit in the community of people building up on other people's work.
Yeah, so that's one thing I noticed. I was doing a talk about the F-sharp community at one of the F-sharp events. And I draw a little chart with some of the open source projects I was using in the demos. And it was fairly crazily connected graph. And there's just a bunch of really cool F-sharp projects that everybody's building on. There's the fake project for writing build scripts.
Stefan, right?
Stefan Forkman. There's the packet project for managing your dependencies. And they're just amazingly useful. Even if you're doing C# projects, people still use them to manage their dependencies in a better way than with NuGet and write nice build scripts.
How many contributors do you have on Packet now? Is it 100, 200?
Oh, yeah, we'd have to check the website, but I think Fake is especially crazy in this because it just has hundreds of contributors.
Do you have a good answer on how people are using? So tell us what about Packet. That is maybe something that people don't even know what it is.
Yeah, I think Packet is really interesting because the problem it's solving is it's sort of more apparent in the F-sharp community. If you're relying on all these different dependencies, then with NuGet. You get a nice Visual Studio plugin where you click and then you wait until it finishes loading and then you enter your packages and it will install. There's a few issues with how NuGet does things. So one is it will put the version number into your packages directory. So your project file will change every time you update to a new version. That's one thing. The other is it doesn't really do transitive dependencies. So if I depend on fslab, which is one nice F-sharp package, that has 15 other dependencies. And in NuGet, you'll end up listing all these 15.
Yeah.
With Packet, you just say NuGet fslab, and then it will generate. So you put this in one file, and in another file, you have a lock file, which says these are the versions that we are currently relying on, and when you update to a new version, you'll just change that one file.
Mm-hmm. And it nicely also handles when you have maybe two projects depending on the same library with different versions.
They added this idea of groups, so you can separate that as well.
one of the things I think about a lot is on the business value side of functional programming, and that's the angle I came into FP from. And so, I mean, that's actually a case here of just removing mistakes that could easily be there. And that's a common thing. It's almost like that seems to be the default way that an FP project, whether it's F Sharp, you know, from another community, it's always about guarding people from like the, like if you just lost diligence for just a minute, like, and you that you were then suffering for it for like months or whatever. And FP has a way of keeping us out of a lot of those spots, it feels like. And that's
can actually step in on that point, because like I'm in Thomas all the way, like with Thomas all the way, like I haven't been into F Sharp like before it was cool. He was, but I came late to the game, and it's like there is a bit of a misconception in functional programming for me, which is everybody talks about it as it's if you do physics, if you send rockets to the moon, you do functional, and otherwise you don't. And for me, I love the community, but the other side is like it has been like amazingly productive, and made like discussions possible with my clients, which were completely impossible before. Like I just completed a project with a client who is he's not a developer, like he's somebody competent with SQL, and that's it. And what I ended up doing was every week we would just meet on Skype, and I would walk him through the code. Like the code was on GitHub, he would just download it, run the scripts, edit it. And this was absolutely magical. It's like, I have not written a single slide. We didn't have like reports, things like that. And he just looked at the code, and it was simple enough that he could tell me, look, like you made a mistake on the way you modeled your domain. And this is amazing. Like this is the promise. I have been looking for ubiquitous language for years. And having this situation where the domain is so simple, so transparent that a user who is not trained can just tell me, this is not quite right, this is not what I have in mind, is great. And this is where I find a bit of a discrepancy, because people look for machine learning, look for complicated things. For domain modeling, it's like F-sharp and functional is fantastic.
And like just to second that point, I'm doing F-sharp trainings, and very often what happens is that we have people who are like experienced C-sharp developers. We also have people who are like Excel experts. Mm-hmm. We have people who have never, like at the last one we did, we had a lady who was joining Microsoft Research as a cryptographist.
Okay, cool.
And she actually hasn't done any programming before, mm-hmm. but she was expert in the domain. Mm. And it was really amazing to see these like three completely different groups of people all getting into F-sharp at the same pace. Like, They all got to the end of the training knowing F-sharp pretty well, and so you don't have to be like you don't have to be an expert on.
And you can have discussions on the code itself. Like the code is telling you the story. Like it's amazing.
The declarative side. You know, that's the funny thing. The perception thing is funny, because as a community, I think we've maybe done a kind of a poor job on that. And as people come in, they realize this is really about. This is easier to maintain. This is not harder.
This is
easier.
And, it's extremely effective.
And it ends up being a nice way of having conversations with you know, with people that aren't even in the code, like you're talking. The declarative model is easier to read. That is a case where there's a large code base that was built out of, you know, imperative code. It was a bunch of iffy, switchy, bunch of class hierarchy inheritance stuff, and it was doing parsing of financial data. And this was around 30,000 lines of code, kind of hard to get your head around, you know, what all it was doing. And we went in, and it was basically a proof project. And so it was like, instead of just like, is FP developers, a good thing for us to do is come in and do proofs. Say, like, here's the thing, would this make it better? And then let the evidence decide. And we end up in a pretty good spot each time we do that. But in this case, took this 30,000 lines of imperative code, moved, and it really came down to an issue of pattern matching. And so pattern matching solved this, and it became 1,000 lines of FP code.
Yeah. And you see what happens.
And at that point, you know, so we're having a meeting then with a VP that had never coded anything in his life. And so he was sitting there, the VP that was looking over this reviewed, and he said, okay, this is where you're handling international transactions. This is where, and so he could look at the code. Sorry. He could scroll up and down. Yeah. And if he had been going through the 1,000 files of class files, you know, there's just no way he would have any sort of idea.
Even as a developer,
as a developer couldn't have done it, and much less the VP. And so it's so that thing of it actually being easier, I think is a thing that gets lost a lot of times. And the fact that it does get you the spot of having like faster delivery times and, and the cost of maintenance is lower and the quality is higher. You know, that's this magic thing that businesses want, and as developers we want it too. And this is about the only path in my career I've seen where we actually get that. It's always promised and other things, but we actually get it here. We've all experienced that. You've had some real wins. Can you talk about some of the bits where you've seen that faster delivery time or this thing of
that project was a good case because I can literally. I mean, I had a. Every time I have used the Kev Sharp on projects, it just has worked for me. But that case was great because the project was actually fairly complicated. I mean, it was technical. It was about like optimizing transportation and all of this. Yes. And within a week, I had the prototype running for the customer, and he could just run code. I didn't have to build a complicated process. As a developer, I don't want to write slides. And the code is the truth. So it's like it was really great. Yeah. Like I shipped a script, and my customer could just run it and tell me, like, we need to fix this, like, we need to add this. Mm-hmm. So, and the other case, which was, so Thomas was mentioning Packet, is like the previous project I was on, is like it's a big team and everything, and I wanted to have a nice CI server and delivery, and we put in place immediately two things. One of them was a fake and a build on fake. Mm. And it was just beautiful. And it was great too, because I had youngsters on the team. They had never seen F-Sharp before. Yep. In a week, they got like a whole build working with F-Sharp that was just working fine with a UI test running on top of it with Canopy.
That was Canopy. Yeah, that's what I was actually thinking of just a minute ago, is the same sort of thing of where people that have never, you know, they've never written any F-Sharp. They've never, they've barely written code. And you come in and you have this, again, this layer of...
It makes UI testing easy. And it's, you don't need to be a functional programming expert. All of this, like Hanselman has actually very nice pieces on Canopy and fake.
So anyone that's listening that hasn't heard of Canopy before, it's automated acceptance testing. It's a DSL that sits on top of Selenium would be a way of describing it, right?
Yep.
And you can extend it with drivers, so you can target different browsers. You can target like remote cloud hosted versions of browser platforms. You can do some pretty amazing things with it. And the syntax is tight, and it saves you from, again, like a lot of the problems you have with just raw Selenium of like timeouts and things. It steps back and it's like, okay, this is something that the human shouldn't have to be diligent about. They just should just work. And that's the philosophy over and over of where we end up.
And this is again also to the point that it's not about sending rockets to the moon. It's like if you look at the things we have been talking about, we talked about build systems, we talked about UI testing, and we talked about like dependency management.
Yeah.
These things have nothing to do with like advanced mathematics.
It's just ETL. Like I had the ETL example. So that's
they're harder than sending rockets to the moon.
And so just loading data and saving, transforming data is this other, just kind of boring business thing that is an excellent spot for FP as well.
So what gets you excited about F-Sharp, Brian?
It's the part, it's one of the things that they're just, to be honest, there are a few things at Microsoft that get me really excited, and then there are a lot of things I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting, you know. And it's just not my cup of tea. But F-Sharp is one of the things that does get me excited, because it's a place where this move towards building systems that are less painful to maintain can actually happen. And it is this gorgeous project that came out of kind of nowhere. I mean, it was not a thing that people were specifically asking for. It's kind of, it makes me, so another thing that I was excited about a little bit before this, and probably the lead would have been with Link. So Link, again, was this thing that was, you know, Eric Meyer, he creates this beautiful thing. No one was requesting that. It wasn't a thing of where they were trying to play catch up with some other vendor out there. It was a thing where Microsoft absolutely led. And the code quality inside of your C# code, where you're using Link, you're using functional thing. I mean, it's just straight up functional code in the middle of your C# mess. And so you get this beautiful functional core in there when you're working with linked objects, and the code quality goes up. Like it shrinks, and the bugs are almost never inside of the Link code. It's all in the surrounding stuff and this pollution that's around, and that is what F# is entirely. So another thing is the people sometimes will think, well, I'll do a little hobby project in F# and I'll program in the small and that thing. But a powerful thing comes in F#. The thing that really I love in F# across all the functional languages, this is a superpower, I think. And I think sometimes it's looked at as a limitation in F Sharp, and that's the directional compilation. So anyone that's first opened up F Sharp and they created their first file and they sort of got stung, like, I just referred to something, it says it doesn't know about it. Well, of course, you have to have it higher up in the file, right? It's because you only depend on things above you. And so that's the first sort of toe stub. And then the second thing is the point you've created your second file, and you have two files in your project, and you're like, wow, it doesn't find this thing I'm referring to, and you realize, oh, there's directional compilation, and the files aren't ordered alphabetically. You move the files up and down in the list in the project. And as a result, that feels like a bug. People think at first, like, oh, they didn't get done. The poor Visual Studio team, they didn't have enough budget to have alphabetic sorting or something like that. And then you realize, well, that can't be the case. So what was actually? So if you think about what happens in a small project, that might be just a little annoying. In a large project, you've got a large C# project, large Java project, large almost any other language in the world project, you have this thing of, like, the way you organize your code, it becomes arbitrary.
Cyclical dependencies.
You have absolutely cyclical dependencies because there's no semantics to the, subjective color swashes. It's sort of this fashion choice that you're making on, like, maybe they'll live in this namespace here or up in here and they'll have a slightly different name. But in F# projects, you can look, and at the bottom, you know that the things at the bottom are depending on the things up at the top. Yeah. And there's semantics there. And you know that if you're changing something up at the top, you're likely affecting all these things down below. You know where to look. And you know kind of what level, what your degree of abstraction versus concrete is up
really
and down. And
like
it is, again, a huge safety device. And it's beautiful.
Whenever I come to a new F# project that I haven't seen before, and I want to understand what's happening, I look into the first file because that defines the domain model.
Yes.
And I look at the end because that's telling me what the entry point actually does.
Your arms around the entire project. You open up that bottom file and all of a sudden your arms are entirely around the project.
Yeah.
There's no sort of like, I got this and did something slip out over here. You've got your arms around the whole thing. And then it's like, I'm interested in this. So it's like you have a hard problem. What do? You split it in two and you have two smaller problems. If any of those are too big, you split it. You have smaller problems. And that's the same thing that happens in the project structure.
Can I also
love
react?
Love it.
Because at this is like, in a way, like F# is a true friend in that, like, from a good friend, you expect him to tell you you're doing something wrong. And this is really, I think it's a really an underrated quality of the language, which is like lots of people on the functional side tend to look for very complicated features and advanced ones. And I think the really underrated feature of F# is its simplicity. In a way, it's similar to Python, is like it's simple. And if it's getting complicated, you're probably doing something wrong. Like it pushes you to the pit of success. Like the ordering of files is actually one where, like, you will not have cyclical dependencies.
Absolutely.
There was this joke that it's just has all the right defaults.
That's right. Yes.
And it's like it makes you order your code better. It gives you the immutability by default, which is another really good valuable thing.
And again, we back up to declarative being this thing of, like, where you're saying, you know, computer, here's what I want done instead of how I want it done. And at some point, you have to drop down and you have to be imperative. But that should be, like, at this tiniest skin of assembly or C as possible. And then you need to jump out of that and get to a declarative model that suits your domain. And I think that's what FP is really, really good at. F# is really good at.
Can I completely switch topics and
Absolutely.
Ask you also about, because one thing which I have known you for first is like the polyglot community you're running in Nashville.
Yeah.
So can you talk a bit about this?
Yeah, so you mentioned earlier about people coming into FP in projects where, you know, they weren't even programmers, but they were coming in and they had this introduction. And I think that there's the perception thing of like FP must be hard. And we sort of have proven that wrong at Nash FP. So in Nashville, we have a group, Nash FP. It's the Polyglot Functional Programming Group there, and it formed from an event back in 2009, F# Firestarter that we did back in Nashville, Tennessee. And this is right as the point F# was getting bundled in the box, and there's some excitement there. So we had this big room of people that show up. They gave up their whole Saturday, and we're all coding together, and they were like, "Okay, what do we do with this?" And that eventually became the seeds of this polyglot group. And what we decided is rather than just having it be a F-sharp group, well, we had a good community of Clojure people in town. And I'm also in the Erlang VM, and I'm a huge fan of the Erlang VM for basically all the reasons I've been saying I love F-sharp, is it protects you from like nasty kinds of problems, and it helps you down that path. And so the idea of polyglot, of having all of these different language groups coming in, we have now Elixir, we have Haskell people, Elm, and so on. But we started this group, and we knew a few things we needed to do, and that was we needed to level up the community. We needed to have a place for us to go and hang out and like have friends to talk to these things as we were learning was one part initially. That's still a big part of what we do. But we realized that, like, if without leveling up, what shot do we have to actually do this in our day job?
Yeah.
And so that was, like, we wanted to level up as a community. And then as this year went on, as these people were, so we didn't do the PowerPoint thing in the group. It was all about active learning. So we from the beginning we got together, and this is some things sort of stolen from art school, stolen from different communities outside of programming, and some things stolen from the Ruby community in town. But we did these hands-on like coding things together. We had a few different formats. One was a show and tell, and so the idea of a show and tell, instead of hooking up a slide deck, we would say, hey, I've been fumbling around with this data structure, or I've been fumbling around, here's currying. I've finally got my head around currying, or this concept. And someone would hook into a projector, and they would just show the thing that they'd learned over the past 2 or 3 weeks as they're coding, and there wouldn't be a presentation. It was lo-fi. And so the lo-fi thing really lowered the bar. And another thing that lowers the bar is actually the group being polyglot, because even if there is someone that is an absolute monster in Clojure, maybe they don't know anything about Haskell or anything about F-sharp. And so as a result, everyone is a noob in there, and so it's a very friendly place. And as a result of that, we have kids that show up. We have retired people that show up. We have, it's a whole range. We have high schoolers and college students. Yeah. It's a nice, it's a diverse group.
And having different people show up really makes it more fun. I had this experience when at one of the London meetups, Phil Trelford came with his son, Sean Trelford, who was, I think he's now 9, but he was 8-year-old back then. And I had this like F-sharp DSL for composing 3D graphics.
Yeah.
And I was just like, Phil wanted to do some hacking somewhere, so he left his son with me. And I taught him a little bit of F-sharp, and we built like an army of 3D men. And he ended up showing that project at the NDC Oslo
at the conference in Oslo, yeah.
In front of like 200 people.
And so, Twitter was on fire. That was Twitter all, you know, he fire. Probably was trending.
But that's just what happens when you get kids there. Yeah. Like, it's way more fun. It was more fun for me as well.
Yeah. In general, it has been something a bit refreshing too, because I have been very active in .NET meetups for a long time, and like part of the issue was it's a very close community. And F-sharp has been interesting because actually there is much more cross-pollination between functional communities. And so I see people at the user group in San Francisco, and they come from Clojure, they come from the JVM, Scala, Haskell, you name it.
Yeah.
And it makes for like really interesting discussions, because now it's like we have discussions and you have solved that problem like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But this we do better, and we have like a very, very interesting discussion.
Well, another interesting community is the craftsmanship and like DDD. The sort of, they're also just people who are curious about improving what they're doing.
Yeah.
And like, I find the craftsmanship community really interesting, because maybe they don't really like focus on the nitty-gritty details of the programming language, but more on how we actually do things
and get better.
And get better at it. Yeah. Which is really like,
The Uncle Bob talks, where he goes off and he talks FP, which is out of that line. So you have at the community level, you have that going on, and then all the way up the chain up to the people that kind of carry the flag for that. It's all around FP is a way of actually getting to this safer place or this better back at Nash FP, another thing so around the active learning. So we do this the show and tell very lo-fi plugin. There's another format of a dojo that we started doing after Matthias came into town. So Matthias, if any of you are ever in a town where you see like a meetup thing go out where Matthias is going to do a machine learning dojo or do any sort of dojo, sign up for it, because it's amazing. So we had a group of people that had never done any machine learning. there were like, I guess, 30 of us that for that night. Yeah. And it was an odd, it wasn't a normal meeting night. And so people just showed up on this odd night because, you know, they heard this this awesome person with a weird French-German sort of blended name and these like this MVP of the year and all this. And so people show up for this. And so they'd never done machine learning, and a lot of them had never done any F#. And so after this three-hour, this format, so the Dojo format, this is a really good one to work on, anyone that is hitting the streets and talking, is you come up with sort of an A to B plan of a series of steps, and you give some starter material, and then this template of what you want people to accomplish over the night. And so I'd love you to go into this in a bit, but what we did is, what happened in Nashville, is we had this group of people, no background in machine learning, very little background in F#, a lot of the people, and by the end of it, they had code running, and these are teams of three and four, and maybe there would be someone that knew a little bit more about one thing, and they'd know a little more F# in this, maybe someone that knew a little more about, you know, and so they would form these groups, and then the groups are helping each other, but by the end of it, we had recognizing digits, so handwritten digits, and the whole room had about 94% accuracy on test files.
A working OCR system.
Yes, yeah, working machine learning system, and so that was amazing. One other format there is a lab format, and it's kind of it's similar. But the goals are much smaller. It's like we want to make sure that someone can do this sort of minimal thing in a language. We're not trying to strike for something like machine learning. We're trying to do something very simple like hello world, and then we'll move on beyond hello world and move on to like I'm going to save something to a database and read it or something like this. And by the end of the night, there's no one that's been left behind. Yeah. And so the whole group is leveled up. The common vocabulary is all there. And so we build on those where we'll have a lab of like we have one where people are installing Erlang and they get a server running. Then the follow-up lab to that the next month would be we take this and we build like banking ATMs, like are distributed. And yeah. So the conversation moves about concepts in distributed computing instead of so much about Erlang at that point. So it's like, And so can you tell us about your Dojo?
Yeah, actually, because like first I want to give a plug to Ryan Riley and our community for F#.
Yeah.
Because that's been a joint project with us. And the Dojos have been very exciting because of part of it was what you're saying about active learning. Really what happened for me in San Francisco, people told me, I love the language, the talks are great, I just don't know how to get started.
Yeah.
And I thought, of course, that's an obvious question, we should have thought about it. And so instead of having talks, we have more and more like hands-on exercises. And this is really where the Dojo started. And the other side was like, I went to Clojure meetups and they had a format like that. It's like, Clojure do good things, like let's pick up the idea. And so and the second problem, so Thomas, you were talking about how people leverage open source libraries and all of this. In a way, like the community is reflecting the code and the way we do this, because like lots of things have been about scaling and helping people get better and grow. And one of the issues was we had like two people here, five people there, and it's difficult to find a speaker. And so we started building this whole library of dojos where you go to c4fshop.net, community 4fshop, and you can pick up one. They are like 2 hours. If you're new to F#, you have explanations on how to run it, and you will just be guided so that you can run an F# event in your own community.
Yep.
And other people built up stuff like that, like George Fioranelli built a workshop. Like,
yeah. To make the message like very explicit and obvious, the idea is if someone's watching this video and they're maybe in a place where there's not many F# people around.
Yeah.
The best way to actually get into it is to go to the c4fshop.net,
virtual community.
Pick one of these dojos, have a look at it, find a local group that might be interested, go through one of the dojos because it's fun and it's really like easy way to get started and also to like start new maybe polyglot communities that will sort of imitate the nice
Fire starter kind of it's a brilliant way to start a fire, have a thing to light the fire in a community around something.
Actually, talking about where to find things, like would you have advice if people wanted to reach out to the F# community in general?
I think there's a bunch of things. So the most recent interesting development is that we now have the F# Software Foundation as a non-profit sort of umbrella around F#. And that's the f#.org website.
Mm-hmm. This is where you should go if you want to run it on a Mac, on a Linux, or anything. Like this is the starter point for lots of resources.
Yeah. It also has really good links on like learning F#, and how to get engaged with the community. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of so the F# Foundation yeah, we have stickers.
Very nice stickers.
So the FSR Foundation is sort of, it's been, we've been working on it and getting it approved as a non-profit. So there's like a lot of boring paperwork behind it. But equally, one thing we are just starting is to have like training and communications working groups where that will help in that areas. Aside for like general F-sharp community, there's a lot of people active on Twitter. So if you use the hash F-sharp hashtag on Twitter, that's how you like make contact.
On training, are you talking about like helping groups find out about people that might want to come and speak, or help like kind of the INETA role there? Is that any sort of thing that the group is looking at doing? Or
I would say we're playing with ideas. The bigger message would be whatever people want, the foundation is there to do what the community wants.
Right.
So it's like we're thinking about this type of thing. We're thinking about organizing maybe workshops in different places. Like lots of things are possible.
Cool.
But it's like our job at the foundation is like to make possible, to help people make the dream possible or something like that.
I think it's to protect and grow the F-sharp ecosystem.
Right.
That's
right.
What we assigned in the statement or something.
One thing on the growing, we have this, so Nash FP, it started, and at first we weren't even sure if we'd have a second meeting. And people loved it. And then later in that same year, people were saying, this is the most fun 3 hours of my month. And that was like, yay, we win, you know? It's like, this is awesome, it's not gonna go away. And then, but I started hearing that a few times, and it then felt like, this isn't like great. This is, people should be doing this 8 hours a day, and not 3 hours a month. And that's sad, you know? Because it's not fringe, crazy stuff. This is the responsible way to build software. And it turns out that it's easier, cost less and all this than the other routes. So on so many levels it makes sense to do, and it's just tragic that we have all this cost and waste going on in industry where we, you know, so the FP people that have been in this and know this, where people are starting to come around and people are coming in from the community and they know that there's something real here. They're at a technical level low enough where they sense it. They know that it's real. They know it's not hype, you know. And then they learn it's like, wow, this is not just hype. Not hype. It's actually been from the fundamentals of beginnings of computing, the 1930s at Princeton. You know, you know, it goes all the way back. It's like these two paths. And so at the point you realize is it's not hype. It has substance. It has all these business things. I want to do this. But then you're like, companies, they haven't, the business folks haven't understood this side. And so that's the thing on the communication side.
That's
I'm really interested in like what the F-sharp org and like what we can all do. And I'd really love to hear, I'm sure F-sharp org would love to hear, like what in the community, the stories that, this would be a brilliant thing to have. If people that were watching this, if you've had success getting adoption of F-sharp in your shop, we'd love to hear that. And if you've had trouble with it, what were the objections? What was the problem? We'll really do our best to try to help that.
The F-sharp, like one of the good things on the F-sharp org website is that we have testimonials.
Yes.
Which is like a huge list of people.
Success stories
with F-sharp in business, solving real problems. And there's like everything from like finance to just business applications.
Games.
Networking. The funniest one is there was actually a project to design the new dome of the
Abu Dhabi
Louvre Museum.
The fake one.
That's what the French says. There's this like massive dome that covers the whole area, and it lets some sunlight through it, but it's sort of to provide shading, and they modeled this with F-sharp. So that's the F-sharp dome where we'll hopefully host the next F-sharp conference. I'm thinking we should do that.
Maybe can I, would you have like closing words, like things, a final message for?
Closing words, the last words. I think that the one thing is, like if people are interested, go to fsharp.org. That's the best way to get started.
Another thing too is ping the polyglot groups out there. If you are interested, so Nash FP We've had a bunch of groups that have started, that have used it as a template. And so there are groups around the country, around the world, that have basically modeled off of NASHFP. If anyone wants, what we should do is put together a starter packet and have up on F#.org about that very thing. And so we'll work on getting that of like how these jumpstart kits of creating groups. And so that's another thing, is like, get your local folks involved in this, and it'll be fun and sustainable.
Maybe
point.
I'll merge this into one statement, which is like, we love you, and we want to hear about you, and we'll make it happen. Like, the community is extremely friendly, and we love to have people come to us or reach out.
Yeah, and we have to shut it down because Seth is coming.
Seth's coming.
Oi, oi, oi.